All right, our youth and kids can head on out. I'm sorry, youth are staying here. Youth, get back here, you are stuck with me. But you get food afterwards, so you know, it all evens out. So meeting in this room throughout the year without shades on the window is really an astronomy lesson, because each week the light falls in a little different kind of place, as you know, and I don't know a lot about astronomy, but as the sun rotates around the earth, I'm just kidding, that's not how it works. You should have laughed at that. You guys know less than I do. Okay. So there is one week that happens where all of a sudden we can no longer put the screen right here because it's totally washed out. So we now know it's the time. So next week we will try and help me remember that setup team to figure something else out. So I'm sorry for those of you. We got a bunch of visitors, and you're probably sitting in the sunshine because you didn't know that you'd be blinded, and you probably can't see the words up there, and you're thinking, well, this is a great place to come on a Sunday night. We will rectify that next week. Not the sun. I can't do anything about the sun, but we will have the screen someplace where you can actually see it. I'm excited to start tonight in what will be kind of a small series in the lectionary text for the coming weeks. We, you have a New Testament track, a gospel track, you have, an Old Testament track. And we're going to kind of jump onto that Old Testament track. We're going to spend a couple weeks kind of following along in 1 Samuel. Now we're going like verse by verse, but we're kind of catching these stories that are going throughout 1 Samuel. And I want to talk about these. I really love some of these stories that are coming up. They're ones we haven't talked about in our kind of short history here. And so I'm excited to do that. Although I do want to spend some time tonight kind of setting up the context. And as we talk about a good bit here, context is always very, very important, right? We need context to truly understand anything. If I were to utter the phrase to you, I cannot believe what John Chandler has done. That could go a lot of different directions, right? Now, if John burned down my house, then you understand the context of that. If John handed me a check for $1 million, then you understand the context for that. If he did both, it'd be confusing, but John's unpredictable. You never know. So, context matters. And so as we're kind of jumping into the story, I want to give you a little bit of a history lesson tonight. And those of you who may hear the word history and have your eyes kind of roll back into your head, we're going to go through it quick. But I want to just do a thumbnail kind of sketch of what's been happening in the history of Israel up to the point of what we're going to talk about tonight, because it's important to understand how it goes. Now, if you've spent any time reading through the Old Testament and reading through kind of the story of Israel, you will know that it would give any soap opera today a run for its money. I mean, it is all over the place, right? There's this kind of a love story between God's chosen people and God, with a whole lot of fights and bloodshed and name calling. I mean, it just gets messy, right? It's all over the place, up and down, very bipolar. And so we are entering into a part of the story that kind of comes, again, within that context. Not too long, really, in the narrative, as we're reading through the Old Testament, not too long before this point, Israel, as a people, are enslaved, right? They are the subjects of Egypt. They have to do what they are told. They work every day building what Egypt wants them to build. They have no rights. They are owned. And they cry out to God because it is no fun being a slave. It is no fun, working for the Egyptians like this. And so they call out to God, and God hears the cries of his people, and God chooses Moses. Moses goes and comes before the Pharaoh, and we have all the plagues, and we have the let my people go, and you guys have probably seen the cartoon and the movie, so you may be familiar with this part, right? And eventually what we have is a people of God having what's called the Exodus, right? It's so important. There's a book of the Bible named after it. You should read it. And what happens is the people of God are delivered out of slavery. They're taken through the sea, and the sea parts before them, right? Pharaoh ends up changing his mind, goes to chase him down, and the sea closes back up and swallows the Pharaoh's people. And so you have this deliverance of God. People who are crying out to God, God who hears their cries, God who steps into the creation and does this amazing, miraculous work, this thing that could never be done. Israel could never overthrow Egypt. They are small and weak and insignificant slaves, and then here they are basically making a break for it and getting away with it. So God helps them kind of escape, gives them freedom, makes them their own people. And at this point, this is when God gives them what's called the law, right? You have the Ten Commandments, you have the law, you have this this set of this way of living, this kind of contract, this covenant between God and God's people, where they say, all right, we don't have a king, we don't have an army, we don't have any of the things that a normal country or, you know, group of people have, but we have this special direct relationship with God, and this law is how we know how we interact with each other. Think of it like a marriage. Right, there's certain, it's not, your marriage isn't made up solely of rules, but there are boundaries to the marriage, right? If we're going to love each other, there's certain things we will do and we won't do, and there's certain ways we will behave and won't behave, because we love each other and this is how we do things. And so that's what the law is. And I know we tend to think of it as just a list of rules, but as you read through the text, and someday we'll do this of the law being passed down, what you'll realize, even in the Old Testament, it's all marital language. It's marital images that are going on there. It's very cool stuff. And so this orders the way of living and behaving and treating each other and treating God and acting towards God. And again, it's like a marriage between God and God's people. But it doesn't take long for the people of God to get nervous about this new way of living. In fact, it doesn't take very long at all. And pretty soon they begin to doubt these promises of God, even though, you know, the sea opened up for them and let them cross. They begin to get uncomfortable with this kind of new way of living, because no one organizes themselves like this, right? This is a crazy way to do life. And so they begin to fail, and they begin to doubt the promises, and they begin to worship idols, and they do all kinds of things. And at one point, it gets so bad that they essentially kind of say to Moses, "Let's just go back to Egypt. I mean, at least we knew what we were getting there, right? I mean, you know, it's predictable. We were used to it. I mean, it wasn't fun, but we were used to it. I mean, they almost wanted to be slaves again. And so God has to kind of step in and do this thing to kind of etch a sketch the minds and hearts, that's not a Hebrew term, but to etch and sketch the minds and hearts of his people. And this is when you have what's called, the 40 years in the desert. And there's 40 years where people, and if you look at it geographically, I mean, they're really bad with directions. There's no way they should be lost that long in that small of an area. But it's this time where God basically reteaches them how to be human, right? Because they got nothing to depend on. They're in the desert. And so God sends manna every morning. And so they're totally dependent on God to meet their needs, right? And if they gather more manna than they can actually eat, and God says, don't gather more, just take what you need, don't worry, I'll provide more the next day. And of course, some of them go, well, I mean, I'll just take a little extra just in case God doesn't provide the next day. And it spoils and makes their tents reek to high heaven, right? So they, you know, it spoils every day. So every day they have to relearn that we depend on God. God is the one that provides. God's the one that provides. And there's nothing to build out there. There's nothing to do out there. So they're unlearning what it means to be a slave, which is like your entire life is whatever work I'm getting done, right? That's the only value you have as a slave, is what work am I performing? And so God is reteaching them how to be his people in this time. And so they have these 40 years wandering in the desert where they relearn how to be the people of God. And then Moses dies before they make it to the promised land, but Joshua leads them across the Jordan. They settle in Canaan. They settle in the promised land. They conquer everyone that's in their way. And now they are a people, and they have a land, and the 12 tribes divided up, and they are doing really well, right? And then you get to this stage where you basically, in the text of the Old Testament, have seven rounds of the same thing. The Israelites don't learn quickly. This is a big thing. And you know, I'll pretend like we're different because we have that distance to get to say it. But there's seven rounds of something happening, which is the people of God taking on an idol of some sort, trusting in something other than God. So there's these rounds of idolatry, and then because they basically say to God, hey, look, appreciate everything, but we're going to trust this instead of you. And God tends to be in the Old Testament a God who says, okay, even when it's a bad idea, right? Okay, we're not going to trust you anymore. We're going to trust this instead. And God steps back and says, okay. And then they immediately basically get conquered because God's, you know, protection is not around this group of people who are not big enough and strong enough to, you know, overthrow their enemies. And then they cry out to God and say, oh my gosh, what a terrible mistake. As it turns out, we love you. We would really like you back in our lives. And so God comes in and delivers them. And then there's seven rounds of this same thing happening. Already, this is a bad relationship. If you're in marital counseling, you would know this is a bad relationship, right? Same thing over and over again, seven times. You know what? We don't need you anymore. We're good. Conquered. Oh man, we really need you. Deliver. Idolatry. You know, conquered. Cry out. Delivered. Seven times over and over. And each time, God will like install this, what's called a judge, someone who is among the people, and he's not a king, but he's someone who helps them understand what God wants for them, who helps them solve their problems, who kind of is God's mouthpiece to them. And God puts these judges in place. And you can read that in the Old Testament as well. You can read. You should definitely read Judges because it's crazy. If you haven't read Judges, you should read Judges. There's some nutso stories in Judges. And that's kind of the point of the story that we get into. We are going into the last of these judges that God has kind of installed to be his mouthpiece and to help his people learn to finally be his people instead of these folks that kind of run around and take on other idols. Right as we get to this last judge, and this last judge, his name is Samuel. And Samuel is a good judge, and things are going well for them. But what ends up happening, we'll get into that now. Let's go ahead and read the text. I try to get through it quick. You guys all right? I know there's a lot. I know it's history. I know it makes you feel bad. All right, let's go. 1 Samuel 8, we're going to look at verses 4 through 18. It says this on the screen. You can't see it, but trust me. So all the Israelite elders got together and went to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, quote, listen, you are old now. It's a good start, right? I mean, it's a great conversation starter right there. They're, very adept. Listen, you're old, and your sons don't follow in your footsteps. So appoint us a king to judge us like all the other nations have. So stop right there. A little bit earlier in the text, if we had kind of read more before it, what you'd see is that Samuel was a judge. He's getting older. He's going to pass on this job of judging to his sons. His sons are not very righteous people. His sons are taking bribes. His sons are doing all kinds of things they're not supposed to do. They're perverting justice. So the very thing that you don't want in a judge, his sons are kind of living into. And so everyone's getting nervous because they're afraid all this is going to get handed off to his sons, and his sons are not really all that great. So they say, you know what? Let us be like every other nation. Let's have a king. It seemed very bad to Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So he prayed to the Lord. The Lord answered Samuel, quote, comply with the people's request, everything they ask of you, because they haven't rejected you. No, they've rejected me as king over them. They are doing to you only what they have been doing to me from the day I brought them out of Egypt to this very minute, abandoning me and worshiping other gods. So comply with their request, but give them a clear warning, telling them how the king will rule over them. So Samuel thinks, this doesn't feel right. I don't really think this is right. But maybe he's wondering, okay, is it just me? Are my feelings getting hurt here? And God says, no, it's a terrible idea, but don't worry, they're not rejecting you. They're just doing what they've done over and over and over again from the time they stepped out of that water and it closed behind them, right? They're choosing other gods over me. But if that's what they want, give it to them. But before you give it to them, tell them the truth about what's coming if they choose this, right? I'll let them have it, but if they have it, let them know what's coming with it. And this is where we get into the real kind of, to me, the meat of this text. Then Samuel explained everything the Lord had said to the people who were asking for a king. This is how the king will rule over you, Samuel said. So if you want this, this is what's going to happen. He will take your sons and will use them for his chariots and his cavalry as runners for his chariot. He will use them as commanders of troops of 1,000 and troops of 50, or do his plowing or his harvesting, or make his weapons or parts for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers or cooks or bakers. He will take your best fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will give 1/10 of your grain and vineyards to his officials and servants. He will take your male and female servants along with your best cattle and donkeys and make them do his work. He will take 1/10 of your flocks. And then you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out, right? God's like, look, we've gone on this road, 7 or 8 times now. When that day comes, you will cry out because of the king you chose for yourself, but on that day, the Lord won't answer you. Right? We're breaking this cycle right here. But the people refused to listen to Samuel and said, no, there must be a king over us so we can be like all the other nations. Our king will judge us and lead us in our fights and battles. Samuel listened to everything the people said and repeated it directly to the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, comply with their request and give them a king. Samuel then told the Israelite people, go back, each of you, to your hometown. Okay, so we have, again, this story. They come forward, and it's a little different version than what's happened before, but it's the same basic story, right? They go, you know what, this whole God's our king thing, we're getting uncomfortable with that. We look at all the other nations, we look at their armies, we look at how powerful they are. We want to be more like them. So let's do away with this judge thing, let's do away with God as king, and I want you to give us a king so we can be like other people. right? And Samuel begins to list, okay, but you know what's going to come with that, right? You know what comes with the king. And boom, 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 boom. Here's the list, the laundry list of things that are coming to the king. They go, no, our king is going to be like this. So just give it to us, right? So there's a very, to me, very kind of powerful text. And the question is, what is this really about? And initially, as I was kind of thinking about it, I thought, man, I don't know if I can preach this, because this to me seems like a critique of like government and political systems and the kingdoms of the world, and it just kind of gets into some territory, you know, I don't necessarily really want to talk about. And the truth is, it's not altogether incorrect. In fact, I've heard this passage used to talk about kind of politics, right? There is a certain conversation to be had about the nature of our governments and the nature of our kingdoms of this world, whether or not they ever really end up serving people or they just kind of take, whether or not they lead or they just get others to fight for them and those kind of things, right? I mean, you could certainly argue that this text, I think, kind of clearly lays out some of the fundamental differences between the kingdoms of the world and the kingdom of God, right, which are two very different things. In the kingdom of the world, whoever leads, leads by standing on the backs or the shoulders of the people that are underneath them. The sacrifice is always borne by those on whose backs the wars are fought and taxes are levied. And then you have the kingdom of God, where there is a Lord who gives and sacrifices and dies to benefit his people. Right? There's a kingdom where the last are first and the first are last, and the meek inherit the earth and the outcasts are invited. Right? And you see, it's a very peculiar and upside down and backwards way of doing things, right? And the kingdom of God is not just that you take Jesus and you make him the king of a normal kind of kingdom. You just flip the whole thing on his head. It's something totally different. Your king is your chief servant, right? So we don't even, as Christians, I don't think we even really totally know what to do with this. It's so kind of foreign to us. And I think these scriptures are a pretty valid kind of critique of the way we do things and the way we structure authority and all those kind of things. But I don't actually think this is chiefly about government. And that's good, because I'm pretty ignorant of government. I wouldn't have much to say. But God seems to indicate this is pretty clearly about idolatry, right? God says that, look, they haven't rejected you. They've rejected me as king over them. This is about having idols. Idolatry. Let's talk about that for a minute. Okay, if there is a God, and for more on that, listen to last week's talk on podcast. I believe there is. If there is a God, then that God, the creator of all things, the designer of life, the one that has breathed life into our lungs and has given us every good gift in this world, that God warrants a certain place in our lives, a certain place in our world, right? God is the creator and designer and the giver of life. He is a source of meaning and love and identity. He is the way, the truth, and the life, fill in the blank. And there is a place of leadership, or to use scriptural terms, lordship in our lives and in our world that is only rightfully occupied by God. God is the only one qualified for such a position. To assign anything or anyone else in that place is what we mean when we say idolatry. It is putting someone or something else in the place of God. It is a fake God, little g. Now, it might be forming a gold statue of a calf and praying to it, which I imagine most of you haven't done. Maybe you have. Or it might be trusting a king, or it might be trusting a large paycheck, or it might be trusting your own arsenal of firearms, or whatever it is that gives you your identity and makes you feel safe and secure in this world. Either way, it can be an idol. We look to it to give us things and to provide things that only God can provide. It is something that is not God occupying the place and role of God in our lives. So if we think about it in these terms, what we realize is that this is not just a story about Israel wanting to be like every other kingdom of the world and effectively proceed without God. This is each of our stories and how we trade the ultimate reality for something that we will ultimately regret. It's about idolatry. And I know that the language of idol is kind of strange for us. Again, I would imagine most of you have never formed a gold calf or, you know, lit incense and done some prayer to some statue or something like that, that, you know, you probably haven't done those things. But I think if we let this story kind of identify for us what some of the characteristics are of an idol, we might realize and recognize that we actually do have idols in our lives. I want to use this story as a way of trying to identify what idols might be in our lives, what people or activities or things play God's rightful role. And what really causes us just to look like everyone else, but still leaves us worse for the wear? There's a couple of good indications, according to this text, I think, of how to know you have an idol on your hand. So how do you know if you have an idol on your hand? First thing I think you realize in this text is you see that an idol always takes and doesn't try to relate. I'm sorry that rhymes. I don't normally like to do that, but it just worked out that way. Nothing else will rhyme in here, I promise. An idol takes and it doesn't seek to relate. It's not seeking relationship, it's seeking to extract. I think the most disturbing part of Samuel's description of what the Israelites are going to go get with a king is that word. You notice the word take is used 5 times in that short description. And there's other synonyms in there as well, but the word specifically that we translate as take is used 5 times in the description as a king. He will take your sons. He will take your daughters. He will take your property. He will take 1/10 of your sheep. He will take your servants and cattle. I'm sure the servants really love being put with the cattle and donkeys there. This is the description of the idol. He's going to take, 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 take. That is their primary function, to take. This is what's so sad about Israel's delusions of the benefits of being like everyone else, right? Not our king. Our king will lead us and fight our battles. It's really naive, isn't it? Have you ever seen a king on the front line with a sword? No. Kings don't fight the battles. The kings send other people to fight the battles, right? Our king will lead and fight our battles. No, your king will lead by gathering everything for himself. Your king will fight his battles with your children and your property. The king will not give you security and leadership. He will just keep taking for himself and protecting himself and enriching himself. He will not be on the front line pulling his sword first. That is something you can be sure of, right? Idols take. And this is true of us today as well. Now again, I don't think there's anyone in here that's trying to have a king elected in the U.S. I doubt that's your idol of choice. But we've got them, and they all take. Maybe it's the idol of consumption. That's one of our favorites in America. It always takes the idol of consumption, right? We're convinced somehow through marketing or through, you know, just the larger forces of our culture, we're convinced that whatever we own will somehow give us some kind of meaning, will somehow arrive, we'll get value or peace or comfort or security if we just kind of acquire the right things. So we keep buying, we keep getting more and more. We need this and that so we can finally arrive at that place. And of course, that place never comes, right? And consumerism just keeps taking because it's an idol. You will never find someone so rich that there's not something else they need. Right? You just won't. If you've met the person, I'd like to meet them because they're a better human being than I am. By any reasonable standards, I've got far more than I could ever, ever need, but there's still a lot of stuff I need. Yeah. I worked for people in college over on the island of Palm Beach that made, their accountant told me they made $50,000 a week in interest on their money. Like, more money than you could ever spend. Miserable. Always needed more. Right? Consume, consume, consume. That's just kind of the nature of who we are. Consumerism is an idol. It's something that offers you meaning, offers you security, offers you, can't deliver it, but always takes. Because idols take. Or maybe another idol that we have here in America is the idol of like youth and sex appeal, right? Staying young and hot. Convinced that if we just, you know, stave off the gray hair or the belly fat, if we can add 2 more to that 6-pack and make it 8, if we can get rid of that receding hairline, then we'll matter. Then I'll feel better about myself. Then I'll be something, right? And working to achieve that or maintain it is never ending, right? It just takes and takes and takes and takes. Youth and sexiness always takes. The attempt to maintain it always takes because we never really get there. Again, the person that you think of when you think of, man, if I could just look like that person, every day that person looks in the mirror and thinks, man, if I could just, right? That's just our nature, isn't it? It always takes. We never really get there. We look in the mirror and we don't ever have what we really want. We don't really like what we see thanks to our idol, because our idol never delivers what it promises. It only takes. Or maybe there's the idol of strength and domination, right? If we just have the biggest guns or exert the most power in the world, we will be safe. Except our bombs are never strong enough. We never have enough of them. The enemy always seems to be knocking at our door. I read something not too long ago that says that we have enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world 16 times over right now. Seems a little excessive, right? I mean, I would think destroying the world once would be enough. It'd be enough for me. Anyone else need to destroy it more than once? You know, but we got to have more. Right? I'll finally hit this point where I finally feel safe, right? Except the enemy always still feels like it's right at the door. And even if we really build ourselves up enough, well, don't worry, we'll just kill each other. We never really feel that security. We never feel as safe as we're supposed to feel. These idols of success and money and strength fill in the blank. They always take and take and take, and they never give. If there's someone or something in your life that's defined by that taking and never delivering, there's a good chance you got an idol on your hands. There's a good chance you're looking to define yourself and feel acceptance and love someplace that is just not really offered. Idols always take, but God always seeks to relate. God is seeking relationship, covenant. God is looking for a marriage, a covenant, for mutual giving of oneself to another. God is looking for a give and take. God is looking for relationship, while our idols are just ticks looking for something else to suck dry. God gives love. God gives grace. God gives God's own life for our benefit. While an idol will always take, God gives. So an idol always takes, doesn't look for relationship. That's a give and take. And the other thing we realize is that an idol always ends up enslaving us. It never serves us. Idols always enslave and they never serve. Again, the tragedy of this story is the idea that this idol that they've got, if we can just get this king, is going to lift them up somehow. It's going to cause us to win. And God says, look, you know what you're doing right now? You're undoing the Exodus. You're walking back across the water. God clearly says to them, he's going to take this, he's going to take this, he's going to do this, he's going to take this, and you are going to be his slaves. How do we know? Because idols always enslave us. If we look to something that is incapable of being God to fulfill the role of God, then we put ourselves on this endless treadmill of feeding it whatever it demands, all while we never actually get any closer to what we want out of it. Because it's only taking. If a guy lets the idol of competition and success into life, if I let the competition success idol into my life, I will eventually become its slave. In order to be competitive and successful, my career must take, right? It takes time and energy that I might otherwise spend on something that matters more. It takes relational energy that I might invest someplace else. It takes mental energy and problem solving I might dedicate towards something else. And it constantly takes and takes, and I never really get what I want. And eventually I'm enslaved by it. We're insatiable. Those things are insatiable. And as we still struggle to move forward and maybe grow our bottom line, you'll never meet someone who doesn't think they need another dollar. Eventually you become a slave to that thing that was supposed to give you life and meaning and value. Idols always enslave, they never serve, and yet God, the Son of Man, says, I did not come to be served, but I came to serve. The Creator of all things gave his very life for us. God is not looking to enslave, God is not looking for slaves, because God is the God of Exodus. God part seas and sends plagues just to give life and freedom to his creation. Just to have relationship and covenant with the beloved. Idols take and they don't look for relationship. Idols enslave and they don't look to serve. So the question tonight for us is, what are our idols? I've got them. It doesn't take a whole lot of time preparing for this message for them to start showing up and me seeing them for what they are in my life. What are your idols? What are we giving our lives to? What are we sacrificing our lives to that take and take and take and enslave? Or are we truly giving our lives over to the one Creator who seeks first to serve and then to be served, who gives his very life for us? What are we in effect saying, this is going to win my wars? This is what will make me happy. This is what will make me matter. Only to end up enslaved to that very thing with nothing to show for it. So tonight, maybe we leave trying to be honest about our idols. Trying to see them clearly for what they are and listen to that still small voice that's telling us there's a better way. You don't have to be slaves. You can give yourself, you can give your heart, that seed of who you are and what gives you life and meaning and value to the one Creator who deserves that place in our lives. May we be Kingdom of God people. May our lives of love be given to the one Creator of all things and the only God who seeks to serve in love. Let's pray.
This is gonna be a great rejoicing.
Thank you so much for being here tonight. Again, if you're with us for the first time, we're especially glad to have you. And just know that no matter who you are, where you're coming from, what's going on in your life, you're welcome here. There's a place for you in this community, and we believe we're better off with you in the room, so we hope we'll see you again. If you want to be kept up to date with what's going on at Ecclesia, give us your email address, put in that plastic box by the back door, or if you have any gifts for the ministries of this community, you can put them in there, and we will put them to good use. Don't forget, youth, you got food happening tonight. Find Lacey May, and she will lead you in the right direction. Next week, come back. And then we'll head to the Boyd's house afterwards and eat them out of house and home. And so come out for that. It'll be a good time. Come back. And next week, we're going to kind of talk about the king that God selected, that helped select for the people that wanted one. There's some really cool stories coming up in 1 Samuel, so I hope you'll come back. As we go through our week this week, may we clearly identify those idols in our lives. And may we stop giving our hearts and emotions and lives to things that will always take and always disappoint. And may we instead entrust ourselves to the one true Creator who offers us the only unconditional love we'll find. Peace be with you. Have a great week.